And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. We have a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be speaking with Bob Greco of the American Petroleum Institute in just a few moments. But first up, the gentleman who broke the Jeremiah Wright story back in 2008. He's also the author of Negrophilia. I'm speaking, of course, about our old friend Eric Rush. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Hi.
Well, you know, we were having a chat the other day on the telephone, and the subject of liberal hypocrisy came up, and one of the first things I thought to myself was, hey, this would make a great show. I was disappointed we weren't recording it then. But one of the things that you can't help but notice is that there is just a ton of liberal hypocrisy out there. The rules that they want the rest of us to live by are rules that for some reason they don't have to live by. But why don't you just sort of share with my audience your take on liberal hypocrisy as it exists in present-day society?
Well, what I notice is a great deal of double standard and projection, of course, being someone that is, I guess, referred to as a person of color. I see a lot of this in, of course, the double standards that exist with regard to minorities versus whites, and there's definitely a double standard for behavior and things that one can say and one cannot say. There is a definitely an inconsistency with regard to how various aspects of politics and policy are viewed. For example, there was the fact that, you know, liberals are pretty much on the side of catering to Muslims right now, and apparently, you know, we're not supposed to offend them in any way, yet you have women's groups which you would think, you know, feminists would come out for the condemnation of some of the doctrine that Islam has toward women in terms of their being second-class citizens, and even some things that are pretty atrocious, like honor killings and so forth, yet we hear nothing about that. On the issue of immigration, of course, blacks who are hurt disproportionately by illegal immigration, because these are jobs that lower-income blacks might be able to take, in theory, of course. Blacks are admonished not to talk about these things, or they're never really brought up by their activist friends, and that has to do with liberals being willing, or liberal subgroups, those groups on the left being willing to take one for the team, as long as that serves to advance the aggregate agenda of the left. Now, this is obviously extremely hypocritical. It also is antithetical to the idea of the founding principles of the nation, in that we aren't necessarily expecting an equal outcome, but we should have equal opportunity, and all of these things fly in the face of equal opportunity. I mean, you know, when you have political factions flooding the country, doing their level best to flood the country with illegal immigrants to the detriment of a disadvantaged group of people, or when you have people who, through their religious doctrine, are not condemned for throwing a lie in a woman's face. I mean, those things are pretty over the top when you think about it, yet liberals really don't come forward with regard to that sort of thing on a very basic humanitarian level. You know, it's always the conservatives and Christians and libertarians who are speaking out of about these things, and it is also these groups that are demonized so vociferously by the left.
Well, as far as the women's groups are concerned, I'm convinced now that it's all about just promoting abortion, because if you go back to the O.J. Simpson case, a now famous conservative named Tammy Bruce was at the time the head of the L.A. chapter of NOW, the National Organization of Women, and she wanted to use the O.J. Simpson case as a platform to discuss spousal abuse and domestic violence, and the home office for NOW basically ran her out of the organization on a rail, saying, you know, you can't do that. You can't do that. You're going to offend black people, and black people like us are Democrats, and Tammy will tell you that straight up, that she was told that you can't take a chance on offending African Americans because, you know, they're all part of the Democrat family. So there's a great example right there.
Yeah, well, that is definitely a great example. It's very interesting, I think, as well, and once again, this speaks to the hypocrisy of the left, in that the early feminists, you know, going back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, were not hardened leftists as the feminists tend to be these days. They were actually anti-abortion for the reason that when you had unwanted pregnancies in those times, and of course medical technology was not nearly what it is now, often it was the man who was pressuring the woman to get an abortion when she didn't want to, and off they go to the local veterinarian to get this done, you know, if that's all you had available, and that, of course, leads to the psychological trauma and sometimes death. So the early feminists were really very anti-abortion. That was one of their, not necessarily major platforms, but one of their beefs, if you will. So that really, that really speaks to it, the liberal hypocrisy in a big way. And then, of course, when you examine the whole idea of, you know, women's freedom over her body and that entire concept that they harp upon endlessly, it doesn't really stand up to logic, to rationality. You know, it's sort of like the doctrine, as unsound as it is, has been inculcated into the minds of women to the degree that they don't even really think about it. It's very similar to what is done in black communities with regard to some of the liberal orthodoxy, because when you think of the freedom, quote-unquote, of being able to kill your baby, which is what it comes down to, there isn't anything in the female makeup that really gravitates toward that sort of a solution. If you talk to, and this is borne out, if you talk to women who've had abortions, I mean, there are very few of them who are able to walk away from it like they didn't care, even if they are women who believe that they should have that so-called right. Some of them may be able to sort of sublimate it intellectually, but I know so many women who have had abortions and regret it tremendously.
I don't doubt that. And as far as the abortion thing goes, I would like somebody to call it what it is: killing unborn babies. I'm tired of hearing it called female reproductive health care rights. I mean, what about the right of the child that hasn't been born yet? It's one of those things where I would like to sit every feminist down in a room by herself, show her a video of an abortion and say, now watch this. Don't look away. Watch this. This is what you're in favor of? Really? This is what you're in favor of, killing unborn babies. I doubt many of them would be. If they had to sit there and watch one on film, I doubt many of them would say that. You know, I mean, if it's such a natural thing, and if it's all okay, and you know, they've got the logic behind it, they would just say, oh yeah, I'm for killing unborn babies, absolutely. But no, they call it female reproductive health care rights, and anybody that tells them that they shouldn't be killing unborn babies is conducting a war on women. At any rate, I mean, again, that just kind of gets into the mindset of a liberal. You can't you can't convict someone to death for committing multiple murders, but you can kill a innocent unborn child. I don't know how, speaking of logic, you can rationalize that, but apparently liberals find a way to do it.
Well, you know, as I've said to many people, the more outlandish the liberal dogma gets, and it is getting increasingly outlandish, you know, almost exponentially as each month goes by. I've said so many times that George Orwell would have a field day with these people, and the way that they manipulate language and concepts in a way that is it isn't even subtle anymore. I mean, there used to be a certain amount of subtlety toward it, but now, unless you were completely disengaged, an individual, or just incredibly, how do you politely say an idiot? you're going to pick up on it pretty quickly. It's just gotten so obvious.
Another thing that I find interesting in terms of liberal hypocrisy is the double standard in the media regarding how they treat liberals and conservatives. I mean, for example, you take the Tea Party. Man, you got grandpas, grandmas holding their grandkids, waving flags, but, you know, we're supposedly a domestic terrorist threat, according to the Department of Homeland Security, according to the media. Meanwhile, at Occupy Wall Street, you had people chanting, "Yes, we can have sex with animals," literally. I've got video of that. You've got people defecating on cop cars. They had to set up a special tent at one of the Occupy movements for women who were being sexually harassed and raped. I think across the nation there were 6 murders at Occupy movements, and those were just, you know, peace-loving liberals who wanted to exercise their right to free speech. I mean, how more ridiculous, Eric, can the media get in terms of the way it has this double standard in, as far as handling liberals versus conservatives?
I speak out on that quite often, and I've written about that, the double standard and the projection, in that they really accuse us on a regular basis. They accuse conservatives, libertarians, the Tea Party, definitely, and of course Christians. They accuse them of being all of the things that they really are. You know, like you said, if you look at the Tea Party, which is demonized, I mean, you'd think that they were a bunch of cavemen if you were, you know, from another planet, say, and you heard a description of them from a liberal, you'd think they were the scariest thing you'd ever heard of. And then you meet them and you interact with them and you're like, this can't be the group of people I've been talking about or, you know, been hearing about. And then, of course, they're wonderful, forward-thinking, how Nancy Pelosi had described the Occupy movement as just these wonderful, I mean, it sounded like a bunch of, brownies or Girl Scouts or something. And then you look at them, I mean, as you've probably seen a lot of the same things that I have, some of these people were cultivating bugs. Lice. They were going there and catching lice and fleas and things, and I mean, they were literally living like knuckle dragging, animals, and not a word about it. I mean, creating a health concern. There were tens of millions of dollars were spent in damage from Occupy protests around the country, yet the Tea Party goes in there and they leave these parks and venues cleaner than when they found them.
I think if you talk to some of the park rangers, for instance, who cover the mall in D.C., they will tell you that whenever Glenn Beck goes in or a group of conservatives come in, just like you said, they leave the place cleaner than they found it. But then you go and you look at what happened where Al Sharpton's group demonstrated, or whenever Craig Colbert and Jon Stewart had their little mock rally, they just trashed the place. There was litter everywhere. And that's really, tell me what you think, Eric, but I've always looked at that as being indicative of the liberal mindset that, you know, I think a guy that was on my show not too, well, actually, it's been a couple of years now, James Dellingpole, he's a writer out of the UK, and he said that he believes liberalism is arrested psychological development. They all get stuck in those teen years where they think their mom's going to come by any second and clean their room for them. I mean, they really expect people to clean up after them, literally, just like they expect people to give them money and feed them and take care of them and clothe them and give them free medical care. Those dirty parks are an example of that mindset of, I don't even have to pick up my own trash. Somebody else should be doing that for me. But, you know, I mean, the thing about Pelosi, Eric, is that you remember she said that the Tea Parties were all AstroTurf?
Yeah. Yep.
Not grassroots, AstroTurf. And then you look at some of these Occupy movements and you would see advertisements and classified ads, you know, get your free bus ride, they'd give them a free T-shirt and, you know, a sandwich.
Paid participation, basically, definitely. The paradigm is completely skewed. And I've noticed that, as you said, that elitism of the liberal mindset, it really isn't predicated upon how much money, for example, someone has. You would think that, you know, if you had a lot of money, you would be, and you were liberal, you would be a lot more likely to have that attitude of entitlement and that someone else will take care of it than someone who is less well-heeled. But that isn't the case. It's across the liberal spectrum, whereby you have these, you know, people who tear up the parks and everything and someone else will take care of it. And, you know, that's something that I was exposed to early growing up in New York. You know, I'd go all over the place and, you know, I mean, when you were, it was different because you could, I mean, you could be 10 years old and get on the subway and just go wherever and not worry about getting raped or abducted or killed when you were a little kid. And I used to wonder, you know, why my friends who lived in areas that had a lot of welfare recipients were so run down. And even in areas where the, you know, the landlords weren't slumlords and they were trying to keep the places up, and it was, it had to do with, hey, it ain't mine, I'm not paying for it, I'm just, you know, I'm not paying for my food, I'm not paying for my rent, and that attitude is just, it's human nature. It has nothing to do with race or even socioeconomic station. It's, you're not working for it, you don't care, you know, someone gave it to you, and if they didn't give it to you, they should have given it to you, whereas if you worked for it, you tend to take care of, you know, we're the same people. If they're working in neighborhoods where they have, you know, small homes that are only slightly more expensive than these, you know, little tenements, you notice that the most run-down places they can make look beautiful just because they know they belong to them and they busted their butt to get it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's absolutely true. And I can tell you that we were, I can't remember the name of the town, but my family was visiting a town because my son was playing in a basketball game, and it turns out they won a few more games than we thought they were going to, and we suddenly found them in need of an extra night at a hotel. And suddenly we found out we were staying an extra night, you know. So we went to this one hotel, and we were kind of desperate, and they said, well, you know, all we have left are the FEMA rooms. All the FEMA tenants have vacated, but that's all we have left are the ones that were rented by FEMA. And we're like, hey, look, you know, it's either this or we sleep in the car. So, yeah, we'll take whatever. And we went in, and the furniture was all broken. I mean, the little nightstand was, I mean, if you touch it, it literally fell over, and I had to put it back together. And, you know, the next day when I went to the front desk, I said, hey, I just want you to know that room's been trashed and we didn't do it. And they said, oh, like we said, it's one of the FEMA rooms. Yeah, they're all like that. We're going to have them all remodeled. But, you know, that's why we made sure you were okay with it. And it was just amazing to me. Here were these people staying free of charge, courtesy of FEMA. And while they were there, they decided to tear the places up. It looked like a rock group had gone in and trashed it while high on drugs. So,
yeah,
anyway, to your point.
I think I do agree that it is some sort of a case of arrested development. I think some people would put it down to drugs, but I don't think that you can, you know, blame it all on that, because, you know, it would be unfair to say that all liberals are dope fiends. But that sense of entitlement is something that is really inculcated, I think, in schools, and depending on, you know, how you're brought up, who your parents are, what sort of values that you get. But it's definitely something that is endemic to liberal thought, and of course it's becoming more prevalent with the hold that they've taken on the schools, and how, I mean, the entertainment media at this point is a vast, vast wasteland of spiritual poison. And, you know, if you're young and you're plugged into that to any, you know, substantial degree, you're going to suffer intellectually and emotionally.
I would have to agree. I don't really watch a lot of television anymore. I spend most of my time I use clipping services on the internet, because I don't even like watching the news anymore. But yeah, I think you make a great point regarding this. You can't blame it all on drugs. One of the things that I would like to talk about in terms of the double standard is the issue of homosexuality. Now, when Carrie Prejean was in a beauty contest, she was asked about same-sex marriage, and she gave an answer that was almost word for word what Barack Obama had once said when he was asked about same-sex marriage. You know, I think she was cool with civil unions, but she believed marriage should be the union of a man and a woman. I mean, I don't have it memorized. It's been too many years. But the left just went after her for giving the exact same answer. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that the left seems to glamorize homosexuality while at the same time avoiding a lot of obvious signs that Barack Obama himself might be bisexual, and they've certainly avoided the case that you and I were talking about on the phone the other day, and that is the case of the homosexuals that started dropping like flies at Reverend Wright's church, specifically homosexuals who were known to have a relationship with Obama. These people were murdered execution style. Now, I got to think, Eric, that if it was rumored that Sarah Palin was a lesbian, and right about the time John McCain picked her to be his running mate, lesbians started getting knocked off execution style at Sarah Palin's church, and these weren't just any lesbians, but lesbians she was known to be friends with and have a relationship with, somewhere someone in the mainstream media would have covered that story. But it's kind of interesting. They glamorize homosexuality, but when they think it might damage one of their own, they stay away from it.
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of a double standard and hypocrisy with regard to the gay lobby. And it's kind of sad in a way, because the gay agenda, as it were, isn't being driven by, you know, like the gay guy at the coffee shop that you go to who's really nice. It's being driven by these militant leftists who are exploiting homosexuals in much the same way that they exploit blacks and other subgroups with this orthodoxy of victimization, you know, because it used to be, well, the gays wanted to be, quote-unquote, accepted. Now it's a matter of, you know, unless we capitulate to whatever demand they make, we're somehow persecuting them. You know, this so-called right to marry thing, which I think is oxymoronical, because I don't see gay people being able to marry any more than I can put on a hood and a robe and say I'm a Klansman. But, you know, now if you don't say gay marriage is okay, being homosexual is completely normal, and yeah, militant homosexuals can write grade school curricula, that's okay. If we don't allow that and anything else they want, we're persecuting them, and we come under persecution for standing by our convictions. And that is, I mean, to me, that is quintessential hypocrisy.
And you left out gay scoutmasters, you know, the Boy Scouts of America losing all their corporate sponsors, you know, and then eventually, I think, capitulating to some extent on the gay scoutmaster thing. I cannot imagine any father any father in America, any heterosexual father wanting a homosexual scoutmaster to be his son's scoutmaster. I can't imagine that. Look, here's my take on this, and I don't care, you know, if I offend anyone with this or not, because that's one of the great things about doing this type of a show. I know you're doing one too, is that we can say what we want to. And if Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel want to go to man's country, you know, somewhere near Chicago, and, you know, meet a couple of old gray bears with gray chest hair and gray hair, and, you know, I'm told by people who have interviewed some of those guys at Man's Country that's what Obama was into, the old gray guys, the big furry bears with the gray chest hair and the gray hair. And in other words,
whatever.
In other words, Newt Gingrich better watch out if he ever sees Obama in a bathhouse.
Oh, yeah.
But at any rate, if Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel want to go there and play hide the salami, I don't care. Man, why should I care what these two guys do? But when they start trying to say that is normal behavior, and then let's teach the kids about it in kindergarten, I'm not the biggest Bill O'Reilly fan, but I can tell you that he got it right when he said the homosexuals, they don't seem to be content with, hey, if that's what you like, go do it. We'll live our life. You live yours, you know, to each his own. They're not happy with that. They want to stick their sexuality in your face. Have you bless it? Have you condone it? Have
Precisely.
You glorify it? Yeah, it's not enough just to say, go do what you want to do. It's none of my business. You actually have to say it's normal. You have to say it's okay. And you have to pretend that there's nothing unusual about it at all.
And it has to infringe upon us. I mean, there was a time where gay people did have to worry about getting beaten up on the street, but, you know, that sort of thing has long passed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we have to be concerned with, well, they want to, you know, have practical labs in vegetable sex in grade school, and we're big fat meanies if we say it's bad. You know, it's insanity.
Well, you know, how crazy was it that for a while the school czar was a guy who, while being a school counselor, had told a kid that it was perfectly okay for a kid to have sex with an adult? I mean,
as long as he used protection, yeah.
I forgot that part of it, yeah.
That's
kind of weird stuff, you know. I mean, I just don't get liberals, you know. I mean, I know they think that as a Tea Partier that I'm a fascist, and that, in every sense of the word, I'm a racist. I mean, it's amazing to me how many times I've been called a racist, and I'll ask someone to pick anything I've ever said on the air and explain to me how that's racism. And, of course, they can't do it, but they're like, well, you're a Tea Partier. You have to be racist. I said, well, there are black people in my local Tea Party. Are they racist, too? I mean, you know, we have a large Hispanic group that participates in our rallies, and you know, it's actually a separate organization, but you know, they want to be part of what we're doing too. There's another group like that in Waco, and I don't understand where the racist charge is coming from at all. Now, but you said something on my show a long time ago, Eric, and I still remember this. You said you had suffered more discrimination and racial harassment at the hands of liberals than at the hands of conservatives. Accurate statement?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, people who had I come in contact with in the workplace is a prime example, who identified themselves as liberals, which for some reason they always seem to need to do, invariably wound up butting heads with them. In some ways, there were things that went on that would really, you know, that happened a long time ago that would definitely be the fodder for a nice, healthy lawsuit these days. you know, bosses and whomever, you know, if they find out that you're a Christian or a conservative, or if you don't think like they do, pretty much, it's, you know, no good. You're an evil person. And of course, these things were not very easy for me to hide, because liberals would always be interested in that sort of thing, me being a person of color. And so, of course, as happens quite a bit now, doing what I do, being a person of color who did not subscribe to the, you know, liberal race orthodoxy, I was some sort of, you know, freak that deserved to be persecuted in some manner. So I definitely found, I mean, I've run into people who were conservatives who were idiots, but in terms of racial discrimination, I can't really think of one incident where I can look at a person who claimed to be conservative and wound up discriminating against me racially, or who I got a bad vibe from, or what have you. It just doesn't happen.
I find that very interesting, because the typical belief among liberals is that they are perfectly nice to all people of color, and it's the conservatives, the Tea Partiers, who are just racist to the core. They accuse us of that so much that I've lost count of the number of times that someone has called me a racist just based on the fact that they know that I'm in the Tea Party. Meanwhile, I think it's interesting, getting back to the hypocrisy theme of today's show, or at least this segment of it, you look at things that liberals have said. You know, Joe Biden said that Barack Obama was America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man. He also said you can't go into a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent. Nobody cared, especially after Obama picked him as his running mate. It was gone. Yep. And, of course, you know, Sotomayor talking about how a wise Latino woman with the wealth of her experiences should be wiser than, you know, these old white men on the Supreme Court. There was a PBS reporter who referred to Washington, D.C. as Chocolate Town. An L.A. reporter called Barack Obama Barack the Magic Negro. No one got offended until Rush Limbaugh's people turned it into a song. But, you know, Mike Wallace back in the day saying that these home loan contracts from the banks were hard to understand if you were reading them over the taco or over the watermelon. Dan Rather, just a few years ago, Eric, saying that Barack Obama doesn't know how to sell his policies, and that he couldn't sell watermelons on the side of the road if the state troopers flagged down the traffic for him. All those statements, were they made by Sarah Palin, George W. Bush, Michelle Bachmann, Marsha Blackburn, Ted Cruz, if they were made by anybody other than a liberal, it would have gone on for weeks about what a horrible racist statement it was. But as part of that hypocrisy that we're talking about, liberals seem to quickly forgive and forget racial remarks by other liberals. And the liberal groups out there don't pursue them, because just like we said, white liberals don't want to offend, you know, black liberals and so forth. Black liberals apparently don't want to offend white liberals, so they let that stuff go.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, of course, there was that recent the television show, I guess, Bill Maher's got, you know, the hardened liberal guy, and although he's not stupid, you know, he's finally coming around to thinking that, hey, you know, some of these Islamofascists are kind of dangerous, and he's talking about liberals not wanting to say anything about it because they are afraid of being called racist, which is the same thing, of course, they try to do to conservatives, and he winds up arguing with his own panel, who of course are a bunch of liberal elites who are never going to have to worry about, you know, getting blown up in the supermarket, because they have people for that, you know. And the hypocrisy is so it's ironic that it has gotten so over the top that even some liberals are starting to notice its hypocrisy, if that makes sense.
That's bizarre when Bill Maher wakes up and sees something. Of course, I will always remember Bill Maher as the guy who I think compared Alan West to a gorilla, if I'm not mistaken. So, when Bill Maher's waking up and then you see Jon Stewart going after Sebelius over Obamacare, and then you've got NBC News going after the administration because they found that internal IRS memo suggesting that they knew millions of people were going to lose their health care coverage because of Obamacare. Of course, if you're like me, Eric, you probably believe that Obamacare was designed to fail so we could move into a one-payer system. The bottom line is it, when liberals are starting to see it, it's really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. And, you know, I think that people are starting to wake up on a lot of areas, but they're not quite sure what they're waking up to. And, of course, I believe that it was designed to fail because they do want us to move into a one-payer system. But, you know, to a larger degree, I think that the whole website debacle is sort of diversionary from the fact that it was supposed to fail. You know, people are very focused in on the, once again, the perception of ineptitude when they really ought to be looking at the madness behind the method, which is what they really want to accomplish.
That's like asking a liberal to play a game of chess and think several moves ahead. I don't know that they can do it.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, but I'm afraid you're probably right.
Well, before you go, let's talk about the book for just a second. I mean, you've been on before talking about it, but the book is Negrophilia from Slave Block to Pedestal, America's Racial Obsession. I can only imagine, Eric, that you caught a lot of hell for writing this book.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, it was very gratifying because I think it got the message out that I wanted to get out to black conservatives, to white conservatives. It wasn't really something that I expected to wake people up, but I meant it to give license to black and white, you know, people of all colors who are conservative, that, you know, they need to speak their minds and don't worry about being called racists, and sort of give them a background as to how the race policies that we're dealing with these days came about. But of course, you know, stepping outside of that, you know, that belief system that we're all supposed to have with regard to race and race issues, it definitely exponentially increased the amount of flack that it's so hard for me to fathom when, you know, liberals refer to me as being part of the KKK or something, they'll weave it into my name in some cute way in social media. I'm thinking, do you know anything about American history at all? Anything?
Yeah.
You know,
I don't think they know the tie-in between the KKK and the Democratic Party, for example.
Oh, well, that is for certain. That is for certain. But, yeah, the book is available on my website, ericrush.com. That's Eric with a K. And, yeah, you can find that there. Find it there or Amazon.com or at WorldNet Daily Books.
Now, one last thing. You've got your own show you're doing. Tell me about that.
Full Contact with Eric Rush Live is my streaming radio show that streams from my website currently. We're looking to, you know, it's just started it a couple of months ago. It's doing great. I'm having a blast doing it. I really enjoy doing it. And, you know, a lot of my readers had been wanting me to do that for a long time. And so I'm doing that, looking to expand it sort of in the vein of what Glenn Beck is doing, although I'm starting with on a little bit of a smaller scale than he did.
A little bit, okay.
A little bit of a smaller scale than he did.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, I don't know. What did he put, a few hundred million of his own money behind that effort?
I'm glad that it's doing well, because we really need the alternatives, and we really needed to, or someone needed to show entrepreneurial Americans that there were alternatives. And so I think that we're going to see more of that kind of thing, and it'd be cool to be a part of it, as you were now, you know as well, because you're sort of doing the same thing.
Yeah, it is a blast. I mean, I'm having a ton of fun doing it. My first guest ever was Lord Monckton, who is kind of the anti-Gore, globally known as the anti-Gore, and I wanted to start off with a bang, so I called him and I said, look, I want to start this radio show, and I'd be honored if you'd be my first guest. And he said he would do it, and I think we got 1,200 listeners that first day, and we've kind of continued to go forward and never look back. Kind of focused on global warming a lot in the early days, and then I had S.E. Cup on, and she was kind of the transitional guest, taking me from all the green stuff, getting into more mainstream. But I have had a blast. If you'd have told me a few years ago that I would have, eventually have Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann and Eric Rush on my show, I'd say, oh man, I don't think that's possible. And it's kind of the same way. It's like Jerome Corsi at WorldNet Daily, whom I'm sure you know, or at least know of, because you guys are both writing for the same people. I'll never forget the first time he came on the show, man. I was just so nervous. The guy had, written the book or co-written the book that helped take down the Kerry campaign. And, he had written so many New York Times bestsellers. And, and then we worked together with the Cold Case Posse investigation. And, after a while, it was like, the phone would ring and I'd see on the caller ID it was Jerry Corsi. I was like, oh, my God, what the hell does Jerry want now? But it was a huge deal, and it still is. I always am happy to have Jerry Corsi on the show as well, but it's an interesting ride. And I remember my son, when I was inviting Lord Monckton to come on the show, he said, "Dad, you don't have a show." And I said, "Well, I know I told Lord Monckton that, and if he accepts, I've got a show, and I guess if he doesn't, I don't." And the running gag around my house is that one day after I've been doing this for a few decades, and I can look back on all these different incredible guests that I've been fortunate to have on, that I need to write a book called "Man Without a Show," and that's going to be the title, "Man Without a Show." But anyway, Eric, always a joy to have you on the show. I always hate looking at the clock and seeing that it's time to say goodbye. But once again, folks, it's Negrophilia, from slave block to pedestal, America's racial obsession. We're going to put a link to Eric's website so you can get a copy of the book, and you can check out his new streaming broadcast. It's Full Contact with Eric Rush.
Full Contact with Eric Rush Live.
Live, okay. Yeah. Well, that's you've already got the cooler name of the two shows. Take care, Eric. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care. Thanks for having me on.
And my next guest this morning is Bob Greco. He is the American Petroleum Institute Downstream Group Director. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
For the folks at home that may not be aware of the American Petroleum Institute, you actually represent 500 oil and natural gas companies representing 9.2 million U.S. jobs and about 7.7% of the U.S. economy. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mark. We're obviously a big player in the U.S. economy, and we're proud of our job-producing capability and our ability to provide the fuels that Americans need.
And in addition, speaking of providing, you guys actually provide the government with about $86 million per day.
$86 million per day in taxes, fees, and other revenue. That's right. We're obviously a large contributor to our federal revenues.
Now, what I'm seeing here is that one of the things you want to talk about today is that the U.S. Or our nation's renewable fuel standard program isn't working, and you feel that it needs to be revamped. I feel a lot of people out there will want to hear about this, but I tell you what, it was kind of a new issue for me. Talk to me about the nation's renewable fuel standard program and why you believe it needs to be revamped. What's wrong with it? What can be done to fix it?
Sure. Right now, nearly every car on the road is designed to run on up to 10% ethanol, so a mixture of 90% gasoline and 10% ethanol. And that's pretty much what all the fuel on the that you can buy at the pump is right now. We have a mandate to blend increasing amounts of ethanol into gasoline, and that would actually push us past that 10% limit, what we call a blend wall, and would force us to, force the refiners to provide fuels that could potentially damage engines that in Americans' cars. So we are out advocating for first EPA to fix this in the short term, because EPA can adjust these mandates down to keep us below this 10% level of ethanol. But longer term, we need Congress to address this, because this is a problem that Congress created in 2007 by mandating increasing amounts of ethanol and other biofuels faster than we can safely absorb them or actually produce them in some cases from to provide them to Americans. So this is a bad public policy that needs to be fixed once and for all.
Now, do you have the American automotive manufacturing groups behind you with this as well?
Yes, they are. They're very concerned about this, about adding more ethanol to gasoline. As I mentioned, all vehicles on the road today are designed to run on up to 10% ethanol, and that's what the vehicle manufacturers have warranted those vehicles on. EPA approved 15% blend, or E15, in vehicles before made since 2001. The problem is the auto manufacturers are not extending warranty coverage. So if you bought a car that's still under warranty coverage, if you look at your owner's manual and it says only use up to 10% ethanol, the automakers to a company will not extend warranty coverage if you use 15% ethanol in those vehicles. So it comes down to who is the American consumer supposed to believe, the automaker who built and warranted your car or the EPA. So and we want to supply fuels that do not damage cars. So I think in general the refining industry is focusing on 10% as the theoretical limit and wants to keep fuels that run safely in cars.
I think you always have to hit the consumer with the whiff of them. Now, you've already said this is going to damage their car, which should be enough to get them involved. What's this going to do to the price of fuel?
Well, if we break through this 10% blend wall, that could lead to severe economic consequences. A consulting firm, Nera Economic Consulting, did a study on this and determined that if refiners are required to blend more than 10% ethanol, it could lead to basically gasoline and diesel rationing, because refiners are very worried about providing a fuel that could damage engines and would likely provide less fuel instead. And if that were the case, NERA predicts that gasoline prices costs could go up by 30% by 2015, and diesel costs could go up by 300% by 2015, as well as significant loss of GDP and take-home pay as a result of, frankly, not being enough fuels to fuel the American economy that would be driven because of a poor or flawed congressional mandate. So it's just bad public policy that we think needs to be addressed once and for all.
What was Congress thinking when they came up with this? I mean, it's one of those things where obviously the people who are in the know, meaning the automotive manufacturers, are saying this is going to be damaging to cars. And as the supplier of fuels, you don't want to damage cars. I wouldn't think Congress would want to damage cars. So why is this happening? Why can't somebody in the government be reasonable and change this?
Well, when Congress passed this act in 2007, it was a different environment. In fact, at that time, we were looking at ever-increasing gasoline demand, ever-increasing oil imports, and Congress felt that we needed to do something to address that. But what happened in the meantime is, first, the economy, we had a recession, and actually demand has dropped and is now forecast to drop for the foreseeable future. We're going to be using less and less gasoline because of increasing fuel economy standards and our economy. So we're actually using less and less gasoline, and we're also importing less and less oil because of our tremendous growth in domestic oil and gas production. production from the shale revolution. So the economic, the drivers for this have completely changed all since 2007. So, but Congress had these gallon mandates that required a certain gallons to be blended each and every year, regardless of demand. So it's just a matter of the Congress couldn't have foreseen what happened, and it's for good news. I mean, we're decreasing our reliance on imported crude oil, which is what Congress wanted to do in 2007. So let's repeal this act and let the market continue to work as it has intended to work.
And you cannot always mandate certain advances. I mean, I know at one point we said we're going to put a man on the moon by a certain year, but I mean, sometimes the technology, or in this case, the cars, don't come along at the rate that we would have liked, and one can only wonder why there isn't more flexibility built into this. Now, for anyone who might be listening to this and saying, oh, you know, this Greco guy, he just wants to sell more oil, you know, more gasoline, that's what he's all about. He doesn't care about the economy. You're actually an environmental engineer.
Well, by training, yes, I am. I would just reiterate that the oil and gas industry wants to sell fuels that our customers want, and that work safely and reliably in their vehicles. And when you've got a situation where every automaker is denying warranty coverage, that creates a significant liability for both the oil industry and the auto industry. So it really does become a consumer preference, consumer safety issue, and even to the point where even AAA has come out against these higher ethanol blends. So you've got to, it's not just the oil industry. And in fact, when you look at more broadly the economic impact, you've got people concerned about corn and food prices. So you've got livestock producers who use corn to feed their livestock, chain restaurants, grocery manufacturers, all groups concerned about the fact that we're now putting 40% of our corn crop into the gas tank, are worried about the impacts that this RFS, this renewable fuel standard, has had on their industry, completely separate from the issues on energy.
As Lord Monckton in Great Britain actually likes to say on at least, well, let me state this again. As Lord Monckton in Britain likes to state at least once in each one of his speeches, we are, instead of raising food for people who need it, we're raising fuel for cars that don't. And the fact is, there have literally been riots, food riots, in various countries due to the rising price of food, because so much food being grown now, instead of being grown for people, is being grown for fuel. And we've had riots as nearby as Mexico, because they were protesting the price of corn tortillas. But that doesn't seem to make the news, because to allow that into the news would point out that there is a downside to some of these green issues that are so popular with the media, and especially the news media. What would you say the impact on food prices worldwide has been since we've been having these ethanol mandates?
Well, you know, because we're the oil and gas industry, we aren't the experts on food prices, but we do listen to our friends in the chain restaurant industry and livestock industry, and they have been saying that this is a material impact. It's raising their costs to produce beef, poultry, pork. It's also raising the cost at restaurants because of the increased cost of corn on food stocks. So the people who are materially impacted by this are saying, yeah, this is a big enough deal that we want Congress to fix this. That tells me that's a top priority for them, that it is a significant impact on food prices.
I believe even Al Gore has said that there was too much emphasis on biofuels as the solution to the global warming issue. And when you have Al Gore saying that, then maybe Congress needs to take a second look at it and say, well, you know. But let me ask you this, because every problem has a solution that often involves the people just speaking up. For everyone who's listening right now going, I don't want gas to
damage my car. I don't want Congress mandating changes in the blend that are going to actually damage my car. What can they do? Do they need to contact their representatives in the Senate and in the House, or what do they do?
Sure. I guess two things your listeners can do. One is we have a short-term concern that EPA can help address. EPA actually sets the mandates every year and can lower the mandates. They just proposed the 2014 mandates. So your listeners can contact EPA and tell them that as they've finalize that rule, that they keep the ethanol mandate low enough to prevent exceeding this 10% limit. So, and that's something that EPA has to do on a year-by-year basis. So that's a good first step, but longer term, we need Congress to fix the problem permanently that they created in 2007. Because as you can imagine, it's no way to run a business when you're reliant on waiting on EPA each and every year to tell you what your compliance is. So we want Congress long term to fix this. So to the extent that your listeners can contact a member of Congress and say, look, if this is a big deal, this is a problem that needs to be fixed permanently, we need Congress to step in and correct this once and for all.
Well, now you've got your assignment, folks. Get on the phone, call the EPA or email them, contact your representatives in Washington, let them know that this year-by-year thing isn't going to fly, although, frankly, it's what we do with our national budget right now.
Unfortunately, Congress, in fact, you got to keep the pressure on them because they're looking at it like, oh, EPA's got this managed for a year, so we don't need to worry about it right now. And like in many cases, we can't have Congress to think in that mindset. We need to break them out of that.
Once again, we've been visiting with Bob Greco. He is the Downstream Group Director for the American Petroleum Institute. Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Feel free to come back anytime.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar.